specifically. And I told you that we had finished with the introductory topics. That's pretty much true. I mean, this topic itself is still kind of introductory. But I'll just say one more word that, and it also has synergy points to it. I happened to notice over Shabbos, as we know this past Shabbos was Parshas Kizetzeh, so Rosh writes with the Sefer HaKumish, in Parshas Kizetzeh, he has an essay on Kiddushin V'Nisuin, which, like everything else Rav Asher Weiss writes, is worth reading, especially if you want somewhat, he really talks about a different thing, but certainly a lot of overlapping themes. So if you'd like a little bit of a recap of some of the themes, it's good to read. But just to share one or two points with you, then we will, trust me, move on. But in terms of the point about Nisuin and the relationship between Kiddushin and Nisuin, so he essentially favors the position that Nisuin is not a Kenyan. Nisuin is simply the completion of the act of Ishus through this final stage. And he notes that you see that it's tied to Kiddushin through a statement the Gemara has in Maseches Ksubis, where the Gemara says that Hamakadesh Asaisha Almanas She'en Alai Sher Ksus V'Alna. What happens if somebody says, I am a Kaddish you, on the condition that I'm not obligated in the Chiyuve Habal Lishta, not obligated to feed you, to give you clothes, or to spend time with you? So does that work or not? So that's my focus in the Gemara, whether or not that is a violation of the issue of Masna Mashakosu Batorah. Is that somebody normally... Now, this is actually where the whole discussion is the Gemara Ksufas of Daf and Vav, which has a lot of relevance to other Mamonos issues. In general, the idea that Kol Tanai Shabamamon Kayim, that normally a person who makes a monetary arrangement can make whatever conditions he wants. But if it's a contradiction to the Torah, then we have issues. So the question is, what's the status of somebody who's Mekadesh the Isha on the condition that there's no Sher Ksus Alma? So Asher Weiss points out that it's interesting because what in the world does Sher Ksus Alma have to do with Kiddushin? Right? That doesn't kick in at the time of Kiddushin. That's associated with Nisuin. So if you're going to tell me that by making this condition I am reconfiguring the Torah's view of the process, it's the Torah's view of a different process, the Torah's view of Nisuin. Why should that be an issue for Kiddushin? So what he notes is that this highlights is that Kiddushin and Nisuin are really one process, and that when you perform the act of Kiddushin, it is with the intention of bringing that through to Nisuin, and therefore whatever picture you have in mind of what Nisuin looks like can affect whether the Kiddushin is actually what it's supposed to be. And again, this highlights the idea as well that the Nisuin only makes sense as the end product of the Kiddushin, and therefore, even if we could accept the view of the Mordechai and others that theoretically you could have the act of Nisuin before the act of Kiddushin, it would still be a far bigger leap, as we mentioned, to say that the woman becomes a Nisua before she becomes Mekadeshes. And maybe the action of the Nisuin could take place first, but still the status will kick in then only with Kiddushin, and you'll have Kiddushin and Nisuin taking place concurrently. So one other point that he makes is he gets into the discussion that we had a little bit about whether one can make a Tanai with Nisuin, and whether that's connected to the question of Shlichus. Can you have Shlichus for Nisuin? So he discusses the Gemara a little later in Ksubis, where the Gemara says, Masur la l'shluchei habal. If you give over the kala to the messengers of the husband, so then she's considered to be a nesua l'chol l'varash. She's considered to be completely nesua. So it sounds like from there there's a concept of shluchus by nesuin. So how does that affect things? And by the way, these are Gemaras which I can give you to look at tomorrow if you want some supplementary Maromakumas to tell you where to look at these. Maybe we'll do that. But the message she understands says this is not about Shlichus at all. This does not tell you anything about Shavas. That what this affects is that since Nisuin is a reality, that the Kala has entered into the household of the husband, so his emissaries who are part of his estate, who are part of his yad, so to speak, part of his reach, so then that's considered to be Beis HaBaal, perhaps. That's what the Gemara is saying. And therefore, this doesn't actually tell us anything about Shlichus at all. That this is not using the halacha of Shlucho Shaladam Moso. And the people wouldn't even have to be Jewish. Normally, you would need to have B'nai Shlichus for Shlichus to work, if that's what we were talking about. But here, that's not what we're referring to. We're not talking about Shlichus and the status of Shlucho Shaladam Moso, that he gave over his rights in the suin to somebody else. Rather, we're saying that this is an extension of the husband's household, and she's entering into the household. That's the act that makes her a suah. So maybe if he sends his butler for her, his non-Jewish butler of Jeeves, so that still has the effect of bringing her into his house. Okay, so far so good. All right, so that ends our introductory topics. But now it gets us into our first sugya, which is still kind of introductory by nature. It's on the daf now, but the nature of the sugya is still very kabbalistic and affects every other sugya. So it's going to sound still a little more introductory, but still sugya on the daf. So let's talk about the Kenyan Kesef and how exactly the Kenyan Kesef works. So we know that the Mishnah tells us Aisha nicknames for Shalosh Drachim. So first question to ask is these three paths that we have, Kesef, Shtar, Rubiah. So is there a relationship between them? Is there a hierarchy among them? Is there any points that we can note right off the bat about the relationship between them or what they have in common that others don't have or they represent anything? Any observations at all you can make about these three? We've already made the point that there seems to be a parallelism to Chazaka, or to Karka, where it's Kesef Shtar Chazaka. But beyond that, any other comments you can make? Why does the Mishnah pick these three? Why does the Mishnah put them in this order? Any observations? Anyone see, for example, the Ritva over here? Right, Tamir?
The Ritva said that either you give a couple of suggestions based
on the pasuk. A couple of suggestions to answer which question?
To answer the question of the order.
The order, right. So is the order significant? Could it be in any order?
And it also deals with the commonality of them. Maybe why do we choose these ones? Could it be so common than other?
Okay, so either the order of the three is because how they are in the pasuk. And the suggestion, therefore, is that Kenyan represents Kicha, so Kiyikach Ishisha is mentioned first, and then Uvala represents Bia, and Shtar is in the middle because Shtar kind of flows from Kenyan, it's another method of Kenyan. Or maybe it's because of commonality, you said. So that's not the whole Ritva, though, right? What else did Ritva say? Right?
Bia is last because Bia is actually Usher. It's still Kodah, but it's still the Rabbanim made it Usher. Okay,
so that's an important point. And so according to the first approaches that Tamir mentioned, there isn't really any significance to how these are listed. They're just listed because they have to be listed in some order. So let's pick an order of Pasuk. Let's pick an order of something which seems to make sense. I remember hearing a story, I don't know if I'm getting the story right, but we're learning Baba Kama right now in Daf Yomi. So I think I remember hearing a story that somebody was helping Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky move his house. And he saw that prominent among his farm was concordance. I don't know how often people use concordances nowadays, that they have computer databases which can do the work more easily. But they used to have concordances which would list where words are found in Tanakh. And so somebody asked Rav Yaakov, if you're familiar with his farm, if you're familiar with Emes Yaakov on Chumash, so you know that Rav Yaakov was really a very unique type of Rosh Hashiva. He was somebody who was phenomenally fluent in Tanakh and in Diktuk and things that other Lamdash Rosh Hashiva didn't necessarily pay as much attention to. So part of the story, someone asked him, oh, you know, what's Rashi done with this concordance? You know, is that something you really use this so often? So I guess it's an example. He said, okay, so when you learn Bava Kamma, yeah, says that Bava Kamma, so the Mishnah lists off all the different animals that a person can have and might be liable for if the animal does damage. So you ever wonder why the list is in the order that's in? The student said, quite honestly, no, I never wondered why the list is in the order that it's in. And this is that because if you look up where these animals are mentioned in Tanakh, the Mishnah lists the animals in the order that they're mentioned in Tanakh. So use the concordance, so we'll find out where the Pesukim mention these animals, and you understand why the Mishnah lists it. So my friend who was telling me the story, he's now a Shiva in Israel, so he was saying that that kind of question, like a seventh time around question. That's like the seventh time you learn Shas, you start asking questions like that. Like, okay, why is the Mishnah in this order? And maybe it has something to do with how the Sukkim and Tanakh make reference to the concepts. So according to the first couple of answers that Tamir was mentioning, this is not a real question. Okay, whatever it is, it's the order it is, and maybe it's because of Sukkim, maybe it's because of frequency, it's not something that has a lot of significance. It's just if we want to really be very in-depth in our understanding of why the Mishnah is composed the way it is, maybe these are suggestions. But Donnie's highlighting another answer, the Mishnah is telling you something else, that these methods of Kiddushin are not all equal in their appropriateness. And that maybe there is a viability to various paths of Kiddushin. But that doesn't mean that they're all equally recommended. And that highlights something important. And that highlights that we have Kinyanei Kiddushin not because necessarily here's what we want you to do, but because they're part of what we want you to do, we want you to do something. But the Kinyanei Kiddushin represent something about what's taking place, and therefore there are things that could work, that could be effective, even if they're not necessarily what we would tell you to do. We would tell you to implement, and maybe Bia is such an example. And we'll say more about so that poses the question again about the real relationship between these three paths of Kenyan. And you saw the Gemara that raised the question of why specifically three, what exactly is going on here. So Rav Gustman has an important essay about this. Are you familiar with Rav Gustman? So yeah, it's a common name to everyone. So just to give a little background, it's worth knowing, Shaul Zev Gustman, the Tzaddik L'Racha, was a very, very important Talmud Chacham of the past century. He passed away in 1991. He was a Rosh Yeshiva who was a tremendous gong, had survived the Holocaust and had fought with the partisans during the Holocaust. Before that, he had been associated at a very young age, younger than everyone in this room. He was a dayan in the Bezdin of Chaim Moshe Grzinski in Vilna. Was really somebody of unique stature. I had the opportunity to meet him right before he passed away. And was really somebody in a class by himself. Supposedly the story said is that, and this he lived, he saw, that he was not somebody who was given to the trappings of Kavod. That wasn't really a part of what he was about. He had a yeshiva in Yerushalayim, which he was focused on. He wasn't somebody very involved in a lot of other things. And supposedly it said that he was immune to Kavod. It's the story that's widely known, that there was a meeting in Vilna before the war. Vilna was a place where hundreds of big Talmidei Chachamim lived. And there was a meeting that Chaim Ozer had convened with Kavod in great attendance. And Rav Gustman was late. Yeah, he was a teenager. He was very, very young. And when he showed up, so Chaim Ozer stood up. So the whole room stood up. So Gustman was reported to have said that, so there's no covet he's ever going to have that's ever going to match that. So from that point on, he never cared. Nothing about him. And I've also heard a version of the story that none of what he went through with the Nazis, that was the lowest level that you get to, at that moment, the highest level a person could reach, that the experience in the Holocaust is the lowest level of degradation a person can go through. So he'd seen it all, nothing else mattered, and there's a lot of tremendous stories about him. So in any event, so what we have now are shiurim, very, very intricate shiurim. If you have a lot of time, you could understand them, but yeah, it's very, very involved. You have to, if you want to read them, it's highly recommended. You have to have a lot of time to be able to put it into great detail. So in his lifetime, they already had the volumes available on Kiddush and Bar Kama and Bo Metzia. Those are those three that were available since then. They published some other shiurim. Kiddush has always been around. So the first piece in Kiddush is a well-known piece. It's quoted in a lot of other Svarim. And this point that he makes here is a point that other Svarim build on.
What's the same about?
Kuntreisei Shiurim. A big bullshit. So the Kuntreisei Shiurim and Kiddush, the first piece in the Kuntreisei. So he talks about this idea of three drachim. And he notes an interesting point from Yerushalmi. That there is a Havamim of Yerushalmi. If you see Yerushalmi, I can put this on your Mekarsha tomorrow also. It's a very subtle line, but the Yerushalmi seems to feel it's necessary to emphasize that when we say Shalosh Drachim, that we don't mean you have to use all three. We mean one of the three. So the idea that it could have been all three were necessary. So that's tells you something, right? Even if that's not the practical halacha. But what is implied by saying possibly you need to do all three brachim?
Which one accomplishes a different aspect of the issue?
Okay, so it seems like each one accomplishes a different aspect. And that maybe if you did one without the other, you'd be one-third married. You'd have one of the three components, and you wouldn't have the other. Now, practically speaking, that's not the case, and practically speaking, any one of them, because it accomplishes Kedusha and therefore brings you the whole package deal of Kedusha. But that itself is very interesting. It means that these are three distinct paths, and that each path correlates to something else about the Kedusha process. So the way he understands it, and this reflects things that we've seen so far, there are basically three aspects of Kedusha. So one is the Kinyan, whatever that means that we've discussed at length. Two is the Isser Akuli Alma, the prohibition on everybody else. And the third is the fact that she is Mizumenes Lo. She is designated for him specifically. So to that end, how do you think it lines up, the three? How would you explain how each one correlates with one or the other?
Chesed would be Kenyan.
Okay, so that seems pretty straightforward, right? That Chesed is presumably Kenyan. And if you had any questions about that, it's what our Gemara basically says, and we'll come back to this point in a minute. It's really our topic, right? Because how do we know Chesed? So says the Gemara. Right, kesef, kesef min olam, gemar kicha, kicha, misdei afron, ksif hacha, ki yika, chi ish isha, ksif hasa, misati kesef, sati kach mimeni. So that's the kicha, ikri kinyin. Okay, so that's the Gemara you looked at today, that kinyin is kesef. Okay, so what about the other two?
So the second one about her being usher and everyone else would be something that would be via, probably.
Is it? So it's interesting. Sorry? So Jacob says shtar. All right, so we have Star Wars here. So why would you say Star? I mean, the truth is, I hear what Noah is saying. I mean, maybe you want me to flesh it out for you. You want to flesh it out? I should flesh it out for you. So, there is a big svara. It's an interesting point because there is a big svara to say it should be here, right? Because if the whole point is that we shouldn't have promiscuity, we should have commitment, we should have a one-to-one relationship here, to whatever extent. So then maybe Dafka, that's the point, that once there's going to be a bia between them, so then that itself should make it that there shouldn't be a bia with anyone else. So it's not a crazy guess, and maybe that's as viable an approach as well. you want to comment on that?
I was also going to say that the third reason that she's designated specifically for him, you can say that the Shtar is specifically talking about that.
Aha, so you're explaining the other side of the equation.
No,
so, according to Noah, Bia,
with Noah.
Right, I know, but you're the other side of the other half of it. So Noah is explaining why Bia is about the Yisr on everyone else, and Yehuda is explaining why the act of Shtar is to say she's specifically for him. And it's a fair point, how he happens to relate to it the opposite way. So Jacob, you started talking about Shtar being Yisr on everyone else. You want to explain that?
Shtar is kind of, you know, like a public announcement. Like,
okay.
It's kind of like a contract that everyone can see, and that's...
Everyone else stay away.
Right.
Right.
And Bia is more on the intimate level, and that's kind of how, why it's using that low, because it's for him.
That's interesting, too. These are all interesting points. That's not how he says it, but that's a fair point, too. You're saying that by definition, Bia is a private act, and therefore should refer to the part that's about him and her. And shtar, in general, this is something we find throughout Halacha Shtaros, right? The shtaros they call, you know, shtar is meant to be something public, so it's maybe a way of saying you don't need a shtar, right? If you think you don't need a shtar, in general, if you were the only two people in the world, you wouldn't really need a shtar. A shtar is there to address the rest of the world. So, an interesting point. I mean, you might say it's more true about a shtar raya, you know, a shtar that's used to prove something like a ksuba, rather than a shtar that affects something. But that's an interesting point. Now, again, so I think all these svaras make sense. The four svaras that were considered make sense. And there's nothing wrong with that. But he happens to say it differently, just for the record, that Bia is the act of togetherness, so therefore that jumps right into the Muzumenes Lo part of the equation, because that is the act of being together. And as we mentioned from that parallel to Chazaka, that's one of the methods of Kinyan. The idea of acting as if the Kinyan has already taken place. And the point about Shtar, so that requires a little bit more background. So you'll get to this. The Gemara understands that Shtar, how do we know that Shtar exists? Because Shtar is learned out from Get. So, presumably, Shtar functions the same way as Get, but in reverse. So, what is the essence of a Get? The main message of a Get is, Hareyat Muteres L'Chalad. Right? That she's permitted to everyone. So, if the Shtar Kiddushin is the opposite of the Shtar that is Get, so that is Hareyat Asur L'Chalad. But that's essentially the point. So, that's how he understands it, that there are these three components to the Kiddushin process, and each one of the three drachim of Kiddushin does one of the three. And you could have even thought, like this brief Havamim and the Yerushalmi, that you need all three to have a full Kiddushin. And Lalacha, we see that's not true. Any one of the three brings the other two with. And then he goes on to say that in a sense, it's a little bit true, because if you use any one of the three, and he has rayas for this, which are a little bit involved, but I'll happily provide you with them if you want to see them, that any one of the three really does its role first, and then the other two come afterwards. Any one of the three that correlates to one part of the Kedusha, if you choose that path, let's say you choose Kesef, so then it's the Kinyan that comes first, and the other two come along a little bit of a lag. If you were to choose Bia, then it would be the Mezumenes Lo that would come first, and the others would come at a little bit of a lag. And yes, there is proofs of that. Okay, so now, working with that perspective, so now our role with this Gemara is to try to understand exactly how Kesef fits in. So, all we know, what dinim do we know about Kesef from Beis Amud Aleph in Maseches Kedusha? Or what background do we know about Kesef? What can you tell me about what Kesef is or does, or where it comes from, how it works? Okay, that's a big one. Let's start with that. So somehow we use Ste'efron as the model. So what does Ste'efron teach us? How much does it teach us? or how little does it teach us? How much do you think, or how little, to what extent does the act of kedushin compare to the purchase of Maris Machpelah by Avraham Avinu? What's the extent of this leaving? Samir?
I don't know if this is the extent, but that's something either has to be exchanged.
Okay. It has to be...
Exchange of parties.
Although we don't really know an exchange. We know one given to the other.
Right.
So half of an exchange. Right. If something has to be given forward. Yes, no?
There might be a problem because in the transaction with Ephron, you're dealing with a non-Jew, and how do we know that? You don't yet have an established source for Kinyan for non-Jews.
Okay, that's actually... Sorry?
They're both non-Jews.
Right. Right. Yeah, so you're right. You're alluding to a sugya. You went Bar Metzia, and then in Bar Metzia, Bas Ben Ches. The major machlokas Rishonim and machlokas in the Gemara as to which kinyanim work for non-Jews, and as Jonah points out, what if they're both non-Jews with each other? So that's what Kesef happened to be a part of the discussion, whether Kesef works or not. That's also mentioned a few times here that we do Mechiras Chometz, so we do about 7 different kinyanim. So one of them. One of the reasons why we do that is because there's a purchase between a Jew and a non-Jew, so we're not 100% sure which methods work specifically there. So we get extra concerned and we throw in a bunch more kinyanim because of that question, because there is what to discuss. But okay, so that theoretically is an interesting conversation to have, but I don't know how much that ends up impacting us here. And Jonah points out correctly that we don't know that there is a difference, but... The truth is, even if you want to say, okay, Avram wasn't Jewish, and that, parenthetically, is a big discussion. And the question of whether the Avos were Jewish or not is a big discussion in the Achronim. What exactly Nafkamina has is interesting, or Shechter on occasion has referred to it as Bittul Torah, but it is a topic that the Svarim take up at length. If you're interested in this topic, I don't know if maybe you have any ancestors who are Avos who are wondering. So... The two biggest discussions are the Mishnah Melech. Mishnah Melech has a sefer called Parashas Drachim of essays. Two of the essays are about this topic. And Rav Yosef Engel, I think we've mentioned here a few times, Rav Yosef Engel has a sefer called Beis HaOtzer. Beis HaOtzer is basically an encyclopedia of blindness. It goes in alphabetical order. But we only have the first two volumes, Aleph and Beis. But we do have Aleph and Beis. So if you look up Avos, in the Beis HaOtzer, so he has a lot about this. So the truth is, whether Avram was Jewish or not, it does actually affect us a little bit, because if we're deriving something from here for our din and kedushin, so we kind of have to know, was this a kinyan for them? If it wasn't a kinyan, then maybe that tells us something about what we're learning. Right? I mean, if their action, if you say, well, they both weren't Jewish, so Kesef was or wasn't something, if it had a different status than it would have between Jews, well then that's going to complicate the ability to derive from it. Or we'll have to derive from it in a different sense.
When we see on the next line, Asad Asher Kana Abraham, right there with Canaan?
Yeah, so I'm saying the question is, so what does he say there's any difference between that type transaction and what it meant for them? And what it might mean for Jews, so then that's going to be a problem for us to extrapolate, unless, or maybe because, we want to say that Kedushin is fundamentally different. Right? Maybe we'll say that, okay, whatever happened between them, it is whatever it is. But we know there was a Kesef transaction, and we know that Kinyan Kedushin is affected by it. Okay, so that is an interesting question to consider. What else could you ask about the Kicha Kiyatolim?
Avram was like very clear with the amount of money he was spending on it, even though it was possibly too much. Like the exact price that he paid was very clear. That was something made for America. And Ephron also obviously knew exactly how much he was getting, so that's also important for.
Okay.
Okay,
so that also raises all kinds of questions. Now, how important is it that the value would be a topic of knowledge for both parties? How much focus is there on the value in the Kesef? How much is the Kesef a part of things? And we've already discussed that we want to kind of distinguish between the two, and assuming that here, this case, he was acquiring property, and we've been saying that the kidney condition is not about acquiring property. So there's a lot to ask about what exactly is going on in this limud. How much or how little do we get from kicha kicha mistei Ephron? That's going to be an important question because that may have parameters that could affect us. What other dinim do we know about kinyan kesef just from Beis Min Aleph and Kedushin? Jonah? Okay, so one major question is how to pronounce that phrase. Shvei kesef or shavu kesef? It could be Shveikah, but those who say Shveikah, I think especially in Philadelphia, the Talmidim of Mel Yishvei, probably, but some say Shvei, some say Shabbat, sorry?
Just having too much math.
Yes, there's a lot of great things in Philadelphia, there's no question.
Is the month always a discount dollars?
It could be totally unrelated to that. it probably is, but it's not really Shabbat to that, but... So one way or another, however you pronounce it, but the question of Shav or Shvei Kesef, so our Mishnah tells us that our Mishnah takes pains to point out both, right? Which, as you probably saw, is something the Rishonim pick up on, right? On the one hand, our Mishnah tells us that the Isha of Niknes be Shav Peruta, according to Beis Hillel, how we paskin, and also a Peruta. Don't think that it's only a Shav Peruta, it's also a Peruta. And the Rishonim explain that part, right? Why it says both. One of the approaches you find in the Rishonim is that really you could have just said Shavu Peruta. But it wants to say Peruta because it's talking about Kesef, so it uses Kesef term. But once it said Kesef, if the Mishnah had just said Peruta, so then you might think that this is an area of Halacha where you don't have a concept of Shavu Kesef and Kesef. Right, because as you've probably seen already a little bit from the Mar Makomos, that it's not clear how far Shavu Kesef Kesef goes, that there are some exceptions and there are some differences, and there are some places where it's more obvious and some places where it's less obvious. So therefore, once we're saying Pruta, it's good to go out of our way and say, and also Shavu Pruta, so you shouldn't think Pruta meant to exclude Shavu Pruta. Okay. So yes, so the Mishnah basically does tell us that Shavu Kesef, at least for the purposes of Kiddushin, is Kesef. So now, if you've seen, so the Rishonim take up the question of what is the source for the din in general of Shavu Kesef to Kesef. And what possibilities do you see among the Rishonim? So Tosfos says Eved Ivri, right? That it's learned out from a limud from Eved Ivri. There we have Pasuk. So since we know it's true by Eved Ivri, so maybe it's true by Kedushin as well. And the other Rishonim say differently. What other Rishonim say? Like Ramban, for example, and others. Sorry?
Mizikin.
I didn't hear you?
Mizikin.
Well, it comes up in Mizikin in terms of you pay, right? So you can derive it from Mizikin. It's another possible source, but there's more also. A different kind of answer. Yes?
Did Ramban say, like, it's a
svara source? It's a svara, yes. Right? You could say, why do I need any kind of a source? Right? Doesn't it make sense? In most areas of life, you'd probably say, Shavu Kesef is the Kesef. Logical. So the assumption that it could be a svara is a big assumption. And on the other hand, the assumption that it's not a svara is also a big assumption. So this is something that we have to figure out. Right? You could ask this question from any angle. Why do I need a source at all? Why is it this source? Why is it not another source? There's a lot to try to figure out about this. So Rav Soloveitchik, for example, in the Shiurim on Kiddushin, so Rav Soloveitchik opens with a premise that we shouldn't need a source at all. Right, the idea of Shavu Peruta. So we have Shavu Peruta as a standard in many places of Halakha. But just to give one example that he focuses on there is Zeru. if you steal some money from someone else, so you have to return it. And there is a threshold that if it's less than a shavuot perikah, then you don't have to return it. You're not allowed to steal it in the first place. That's the Rambam emphasizes that carefully, that it's also to steal anything, right? Especially we're not really at the Parshas Noach yet, but it's a month away, that the Boram Abel was accused of pulling shtick, that they basically stole less than Shavuot Perikah, and that was how they somehow managed to accrue a fortune without ever getting prosecuted.
It wasn't stolen.
Did other things, but the Boram Abel was associated with it. So, it's not probably that too, they did something good. this is specifically said about the Boram Abel. So, the idea that Shavuot Perikah, you're not allowed to steal, that's very clear, especially from the Rambam. The whole interesting discussion how to approach that, a little bit outside of our topic. But, if you did steal less than Shavuot Perikah, so you're not chayiv to return it. So, there you have Shavuot Perikah, just like you have Shavuot Perikah here by Kiddushin. And we know that when it comes to Gezel also, there's another din, that you have to pay kefil. So if you steal $100 and you get caught with $100, not only do you have to, actually this is really a din about Geneva, but the same, you have to be precise, get near the gazelle, but the idea is the same, that if you're going to have $100, so then you have to return $200. So said the Rav, would it ever occur to you that let's say somebody stole a diamond necklace worth $10,000. That the person is not chayiv in kefil because he sold diamonds rather than dollars? Right, would you think that at all? And presumably it would be obvious to you that you steal kesef, but kesef doesn't mean kesef specifically, it means anything that's worth money. So if you stole a valuable item, and you get caught, so then the din of kefil should go on the value of that item, even though it's not dollars and cents. So he's assuming that in that context, where we also have the shavah kesef concept, something should be shavah kesef in order to be subject to the relevant halacha, but shavah pruta specifically, but the shavah pruta means that shavah kesef kesef, that it could be the actual pruta, or it could be anything worth the pruta. So, why do I even have to have this discussion about what's the source for shavah kesef kesef? Who needs a source? It's pretty obvious. So, he makes a distinction, which will help us consider this issue further. Hopefully we'll be able to finish this topic off tomorrow. That there's a difference between mammon and kesef. That mammon is monetary value. And some halachos, we're clearly talking about monetary value. So if you're angry that you got robbed, you don't care whether somebody stole dollars from you or somebody stole your diamond necklace. You're just as upset either way because it was the value that was taken from you. So it's clear that in that case, any halachos relating to that, shavah kesef is kesef, no one's going to distinguish between currency and items of value, it's all the same thing. So clearly, shavah kesef is kesef. And there, the idea of shavah pruta, Sefer HaChinuch, by the way, writes that the reason you don't have to return less than a shavah pruta is because it's not called mammon, it's because it doesn't have a value that anyone notices, and therefore there's nothing to return because you're not really holding on to anything of somebody else's. Even though it was a maisa gezel in the first place, but once you did that, there isn't anything to fix by giving it back. So that's when you're dealing with issues of mammon. But when it comes to kiddushin, so we don't know that we're interested at all in mammon per se. We don't know that value has any significance here. All we know is that there's a kidney called a kidney kesef. right? We've already spent some time talking about tithes and smas and other things about whether there's any role to the value of the money here. Maybe shavapruta is the minimal definition of kesem, but maybe its actual value doesn't really matter to us so much. And the flip side of that is maybe using an item of equal value is not going to help us if it's not an actual coin. So we know already that's not true from the Mishnah, because the Mishnah says pruta v'shava pruta, but still the Rishonim will then struggle to know where does that come from, because maybe you could have thought that if there is an idea from, say, Ephraim, that there's a Kenyan Kesef, but maybe a Kenyan Kesef has to be specifically Kesef. Maybe it doesn't tell us that anything else is included in that. So does that tell us anything about the nature of Kenyan Kesef in general, and anything specific about the nature of Kenyan Kesef by Kiddushin? So that we'll have to pick up tomorrow. Let's just quickly review what we spoke about today. Now we'll dive in. So we spoke about, we added just to our introduction, Rav Asher Weiss's point that Kiddushin and Nisuin are clearly linked, because the Gemara talks about Masta Mashakasa Petaru, when somebody's Mekadesh Nisha, Almanasha Inli Sheik Susa Ono, which is really the Nisuin topic, so why should that affect Kiddushin? And also the question of Tanai and Shlichus talks about the Gemara of Masul Shlucha Habal, that sounds like you could have Shlichus for Nisuin. He says, no, it's not about Shlichus, that's because that's an extension of his household, and it wouldn't even have to be Jewish people, it wouldn't have to be B'nai Shlichus, it could be anybody, because it's not tell me on the concept of Shlucha Shalom Kamoso. Then we got into the Mishnah of Haisha Niknesh B'Shal Ostrachim, and we talked about, first of all, why are the three listed the way they are? Is there a relation between the two? And we noted that in the Ritva, for example, he has some approaches which are just details of how a Mishnah is composed. Those don't seem to have any halachic implications at all. And his last answer takes it a different direction and says the Mishnah is making a point that it's listed in order of preference, and the last one, for example, Bia, is not recommended. And that prompted us to note that it could be that there are methods that are here, not because we're supposed to do them, but just because they inherently work, and that calls our attention to something. So we noted how Rav Gusman, in his Shiurim, so he talks about the three together, and he notes that the Yerushalmi has a Havamina, that you might have to have all three, even though that's not the case. So the thought already seems to reflect that the three represent different components of the process. And the three components of the process were the Kenyan, which we see clearly from the Gemara is associated with the Kesef, and Shtar and Bia were associated with answering the rest of the world and designating her to you. We had some interesting suggestions from Noah and Yehuda about how that could line up. That was different than it was in it. Then we had some interesting suggestions from Jacob that was lined up the same way as adjustment, but the different suggestions, all the suggestions were illuminating. But the just in particular mahalaf was that the bia is an active isha, so that's Mr. Menislaw, while the shtar is the reverse of a get, so the text of a get is muteris of haladim, so the opposite would be asur of haladim, so that's the point of the get. So then we started to focus specifically on Kesef Kiddushin, Kesef Kenyan of Kesef. So we saw that we talked a little bit about how the Gemara compares it, runs it out from Shtei Ephron, and we tried to test the limits of what we can or cannot learn from that. Interesting discussion about the matter if they weren't Jewish or not. And then we talked about the fact that there is a din that emerges from the Mishnah of Shavah Kesef Kesef here, or Shtei Kesef Kesef. And the question of how do we know that halacha at all? So that Tosfos brings the possibility of Avidivri, other Rishonim bring other possibilities and the like. But the Ramban talks about the Svara, so that posed the question, is this something we can learn from Svara, is it something that needs a source? And we mentioned the Rav's whole discussion that why do we need any kind of a source? Why don't we just say that just like by Neva, if you steal something, you know you have to pay Keva, even if it's not money. So through here, she obviously has to be money, and he was Machali, very significantly between issues of moment of monetary worth and issues of kesef, specifically of currency, where it's not so obvious, and I left us off with having to figure out tomorrow just how that affects what the king kesef position is. Okay, so I will give you a few more of the cards to look at tomorrow. Hopefully we'll have a share at normal time, and you should stay dry. And, have a productive Monday.